So I just wanted first to just express my gratitude at the opportunity to take this seat. I'm a member of the Sangha and I love it dearly and it's very important to me, so it seems a particular honor to have Rodney and the board offer the local Dharma leaders to take this seat. So I just want to thank you all for coming and thank the board for extending this invitation as well. And I want to start off with a quote. This is by Koshu Uchimaya Roshi. The life that flows through each of us and through everything around us is actually all connected. To say that, of course, means that who I am cannot be separated from all the things that surround me. Or to put it another way, all sentient beings have their existence and live within my life. Tonight I'm going to be talking about the challenges to practice. One way to think about them is the five hindrances. I'm sure many of us have had teachings on that and actually had many experiences of that on our cushions. And I want to talk about, for me, you know, one thing that in the teacher training, Rodney gave us excellent advice. He said, never talk about anything that you don't know personally, which I thought was really excellent advice. So I would like to just talk about how my practice has been actually very much enriched by looking at the hindrances, and something that's really connected to the hindrances, and that's the so-called defilements or kleshas, or probably a good Western neutral way of saying it is the negative habit patterns in our minds. We all have these negative sankharas or habit patterns in our mind that have a pretty big influence on how we walk in this world and really prevent us from seeing that interconnectedness that this Roshi talked about. So I want to talk about the hindrances and the kleshas, or our negative habit patterns that are actually very much associated with that. So first I want to start off by just listing what the five hindrances are, and I think we're all aware of that. Even though, you know, different teachers have different translations of the Pali of them. And I think that those translations are really interesting and can be really instructive for us. So the first one, of course, is sense desire or desire. The second one is aversion or ill will. The third one is sloth and torpor. And, you know, Sharon Salzberg actually calls that one laziness, which I think is a really interesting way to interpret sloth and torpor. Another is restlessness and worry, or agitation and worry. And the final one is doubt. And I have personally added doubt / ambivalence, because I think ambivalence is an interesting way to also experience doubt. And the first thing I want to say about these are that they're not sins. I think a lot of us from a Christian background can think, oh, these are these sins that I need to get over, but they're not sins at all. They're actually very, very universal experiences. They're absolutely universal experiences that we all have, but they seem very personal because we experience them very subjectively. But they're not personal. They're actually a very universal experience. And they are rooted in the three poisons. And these are the fundamental conditioned experiences or conditions that really produce the hindrances arising and the other negative habit patterns or kleshas arising. And I'm sure we all remember what those are. Those are greed, hatred, and delusion, or greed, hatred, and ignorance. I remember once sitting with my teacher. I think I view one of my roots teachers as Joseph Goldstein. And I remember sitting with him once, and, you know, I sat down for an interview, and the very first thing he asked me is, what are you clinging to? And I said, oh, everything. I cling to everything. And he said, no, no, Bonnie, that's not true. You don't cling to everything. And I think he said that to me to for us to be just try to get more precise about what's happening in our minds. There are certain things when they arise in us are very sticky, and they just seem like they are absolutely a part of our identity. And there are other things that arise in us that we can just rise and watch, rise and pass away with not a lot of emotional charge to it or a lot of attachment. And I think, you know, that's an important thing to think about early on is what is it that arises in us that has that emotional charge and what doesn't? For us to really just know more what's going on with us and where we really are clinging, because that knowledge is really the way towards freeing ourselves. And another thing I want to say about this practice for me, you know, I've taken a lot of teachings from different teachers, and for me, it's really quite simple. It's really just about two things, and that's about purification of the things within me, the habits in me that cause suffering, and cultivation of those mental states and habits and behaviors that actually cause happiness. It's just those two things, purification and cultivation. And, you know, an examination of the hindrances and the kalesas is about the purification part, about really knowing what's causing suffering for ourselves and others. So one of the interesting Pali terms that's associated with the hindrances is something called, and I don't want to give a lot of big Pali terms or get all classical, but this particular term had a really big meaning for me and had a big impact on me when I was learning about the hindrances. And this is the term asawa. Does anybody know that term asawa? You spell it A-S-A-V-A, if anybody wants to Google it. I'm a big Googler, so. And this is a Pali term. And the definition of it, there's two definitions that actually have kind of contradictory meanings. One is inflow, influx, influence, and this is a little bit harsh, so get ready for this one. Mental bias or canker. Cankers that keep one bound to the world of samsara. Another definition is mental effluence, so something coming in and something going out. Mental effluent, pollutant or fermentation. And this is particularly around four qualities of mind. Sensuality, fermentation or influx related to sensuality, related to views or strong opinions of things, related to feelings of self or becoming, the self-becoming, and then also related to views, becoming, and ignorance, just ignorance arising. And you can think about the hindrances and the one way that I experience, and it's been helpful for me to experience the hindrances and the negative habit patterns as something that's actually arising and flowing in my mind stream. I think that when we meditate, one way we experience it is as something flowing in us, right? We can feel thoughts and emotions arising, and it's almost like a flow. And actually, you know, I just wanted to say that that's one way that it's actually understood in the Pali is a flowing. It's almost like, and here I'm going to get a little bit descriptive. It's almost like something oozing out of a sore on our mind stream, particularly the negative habit patterns that we have. And the reason why I like this, I know it sounds a little weird, but the reason why I really like this is the juxtaposition or the, laying mindfulness over that. Because mindfulness is like a salve or a balm for dealing with that flow out of our mind stream. And the way mindfulness does that, and I'll say say this probably more than once because it's one of my favorite sayings in the Dharma that I keep saying to myself, is that what mindfulness does is it holds these hindrances and these defilements, it holds them between suppression and indulgence. It holds them right in the middle. That's one way for us to understand the middle way. And that's how they get deconditioned. That's how the purification happens, is we don't hide from it, we absolutely open to it, but we don't follow it. And when we hold it there, that's how purification happens, or that's one way purification happens. So that's why the concept of the asava was really meaningful to me, and it's really useful for me. So I think another interesting thing to think about when we think about the hindrances and other negative habit patterns is, what are the hindrances covering over? Because that's one of the classic definitions of a hindrance is that it covers over something. It covers over what is there. It covers over the nature of mind. And I think it's just really beautiful to think about what is our true nature of mind, because it also gives us that intention or that desire to go back to it. So what are some of the characteristics of natural mind that these hindrances are covering over, or that might be available to us once we set an intention to really look and examine the hindrances? So those characteristics, or some of the characteristics, are natural mind is very spacious. It's it has clarity in it. It's very luminous. There's a wonderful Dharma talk by Ajahn Suchito on Dharma Seed about the nature of mind. It's actually a three-series talk. I'd really encourage you guys to listen to it, by Ajahn Suchito. And he, one of the characteristics he talks about at length is it's very grounded. And it's interesting because another characteristic of natural mind is that it's groundless. Another way to think about spaciousness is that there's no ground to it. But one characteristic of resting in that spacious awareness is probably what we often do more than you even realize when you're meditating. You're resting in spacious awareness. One of the characteristics of resting in that space is that it's very grounded. It just gives you a lot of confidence about what you're doing. It gives you a lot of confidence. Joseph has a wonderful talk in Dharma Seed 2 about the same topic, and he calls this groundedness, he calls it effortless responsiveness. This groundedness means that resting in this place away from the defilements, away from hindrances, you always know exactly the right response to a situation without even thinking about it. You know, and it's often maybe not our overblown sense of control of a situation, but we just always exactly know what the appropriate thing to say or do in a situation without having to take control of it or without having to run away from it. It's just an effortless responsiveness that has the clarity of what's going on in the moment. Another quality of this natural mind is it's very friendly. It has this quality of metta to it. And what's really nice about this quality, the way they talk about it, is that it's not wanting to do anything. You know, it doesn't have an agenda to this friendliness. In fact, my experience of it is that the only agenda it has is to prevent suffering. And since this place sees the clarity of no separation between you and me, it doesn't matter whose suffering it's addressing, because there is no such thing as this, your suffering or my suffering. It knows that. So here's a really great quote from Ajahn Chah about the true nature of mind. That the mind is not peaceful these days, or has hindrances or defilements. is because it follows moods, and again follows this whole sense of this flowing. It becomes peaceful or agitated because moods deceive it. The untrained mind is stupid. Sense impressions come and trick it into happiness, suffering, gladness, and sorrow, but the mind's true nature is none of these things. The gladness or sadness is not the mind. Then we think that it is we who are upset or at ease or whatever, but really, this mind of ours is already unmoving and peaceful, really peaceful, just like a leaf which is still as long as no wind blows. If a wind comes up, the leaf flutters. The fluttering is due to the wind. The fluttering is due to those sense impressions. The mind follows them. If it doesn't follow them, it doesn't flutter. If we know truly the true nature of sense impressions, we are unconcerned. Our practice is simply to see the original mind. So we must train the mind to know these sense impressions and not get lost in them, to make it peaceful. Just this is the aim of all this difficult practice we put ourselves through. So, getting back to what the hindrances are again, they are desire, aversion, ill will, sloth and torpor, agitation and worry, and doubt. And another thing I want to say about the hindrances at this point, the hindrances and the defilements, and that is that the classic texts teach that there's three levels of these, there are three strengths of these. There's behavioral defilements and hindrances, and then there's thoughts and emotional levels of these hindrances and defilements, and finally there's a very, very subtle level of these hindrances and defilements that actually stay in our mind as latent qualities depending on the causes and conditions that make them arise. And we can see how these play out in our life, on a behavioral level, on the everyday, as we go about our life. There's places where one of these hindrances that is a particularly an issue for each one of us individually will play itself out. I had I'll give you one example. Must have been in December. I do something called community-based participatory research. So I work at the university and I'm a faculty in the School of Public Health. And we were meeting with some partners in Washington, D.C., actually, the National Congress of American Indians. I do all my work with tribes. I'm an indigenous person, a mixed race indigenous person, and I do research primarily with tribal communities. So we were in D.C. and dealing with a very, very well-regarded political American Indian organization who are very politically astute. And there's two universities that are partners. And for some reason, one of our national partners, one of the people in this this embassy, this American Indian embassy, was just really had a bad attitude towards the University of Washington. And it lasted for 8 hours, but it was pretty harsh. She was pretty upset. And this is confidential, right? So even during the meeting, I took our other partner out, a very dear, mentor and friend for 20 years from New Mexico, and I asked her, I want you to keep an eye on this because there's a lot of aversion going on, and I'd like you to try to put in some loving kindness if you can. We talk in Buddhist terms because she's a meditator too. And I was, pretty kind of disappointed after because, she didn't do anything in the aggression and ill will continued, but it lasted 8 hours and it was over and it was fine, and I hadn't even thought about it, didn't even think about it. And then a few weeks ago, I had a phone call with these same three group of people, and all of a sudden this aversion and ill will was now directed at my New Mexico partner. And it was so interesting, like without even thinking about it, I just had this incredible rise of this thought, oh, now she's getting it, I'm glad she's seeing what it's like now. just this real pure ill will arose. Like, yeah, so you're getting it now. And it was so funny because I automatically recognized it. Thank gosh, you know, I mean, that was, you know, one out of 99 that I never recognized. But that one was so obvious. I said to myself, oh, look at that. That's really interesting. That was a big, huge chunk of ill will that just arose and spread out. And, you know, it's so great when you're able to see it, when you're able to see it and name it. That's another thing. You know, sometimes Rodney asked me to come up here and be the mentor after. And I've heard a few people say, and this is true of myself, too, you know, sometimes you get just overwhelmed with the amount of hindrances and the amount of bad habits that you see in yourself. It can be just overwhelming. And I'll tell you that at one point you really do get to a point where most of them or a lot of them, you actually delight in being able to see them. Just as I absolutely took delight in that ill will that arose over my dear partner. It's like, oh my gosh, how great, you see it. And that's where you hold it in that place of deconditioning. You hold it between suppression and indulgence. You immediately forgive yourself for, you know, having the habits that you have and hold it there and, you know, provide some metta to just hold it in metta and hold it in joy of the insight, of the investigation of it. And that really does come. That's something that we can incline our mind to, and that's absolutely a phase of the practice that, you know, comes and actually stays. So don't be afraid to really open up to what's happening. So, of course, the biggest help in dealing with any of the hindrances or dealing with any of the defilements or negative habit patterns, of course, is mindfulness of it. So, one way to think about that is when you're on the cushion is whenever you're struggling, and you know you can check in when you're struggling. A really excellent thing to do is just to use your mindfulness to check in and do a little checklist of the hindrances. Am I aversive right now? Is there greed in my mind? And I remember another interview I had with my teacher, and I asked him, you know, what is this about feeling the breath in the body? You know, what does that feel like? How am I supposed to see that? And he didn't even look up from what he was doing. He goes, oh, that's just greed in your mind. So another way to understand it is if you want anything else to be happening in your mind than exactly what's happening at that moment, there's greed in your mind. And it's really as simple as, you know, I've actually taken that label as a very interesting and easy way to label that aspect of my mind, just greed arising, greed, 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 greed. It's very simple. So mindfulness, we bring mindfulness to it. And, you know, I think that's the most important thing I'm going to say about dealing with any of the hindrances off the cushion or on the cushion, and that is the most important and wisest thing that we can really do regarding it, or the wisest advice I have, I should say, is that it's the most important thing is the quality of attention that you're bringing to it. Because the quality of the attention that you're bringing to it will, you know, give you more information about whether it's a, you know, big point of clinging for you or whether, you know, it's something that, the quality of attention will tell you that right away. So, and just to remind us, what is the type of attention that we want to bring to it. And again, we just want to check in also on the strength or the qualities of our mindfulness at the moment. You know, what kind of mindfulness, what type of wise attention am I bringing here? And try to wrestle up that energy and that wise attention to what you're looking at. And again, here's another little mnemonic device that many of you or all of you have probably heard, right? RAIN, you've all heard about RAIN. Which is just check in with whether you're recognizing something or recognize it. Are you identifying what it is? You might be struggling with something in your mind and you can't really tell what it is. Actually, for me, that's often the case. Sometimes when you have multiple The other thing about hindrances on the cushion, you can have multiple hindrances attack, a multiple hindrance attack, where you'll have two or three hindrances actually working together. I'm sure none of you have had that. You can have multiple hindrance attacks, and sometimes it's really hard to figure out what's going on in that moment. And that's why sometimes things won't clear very easily, or you won't be able to see things very clearly because there's more than one thing going on at a time. For example, how that manifests in me is I will have greed towards something, and then I'll have aversion for myself for having that greed. You know, so more than one thing will happen at a time. And oftentimes there'll be such probably, you know, for me, complex emotions going on, you know, that sometimes all I can actually, the only mindfulness I can bring to it is to know whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Do you ever get to that point? Like, what is that? You know, you can't really discern what it is, but you know what the feeling tone or vedana or you know, the feeling of it is. You know, you can always revert back to feeling if you can't tell what something is. And that, you know, hopefully sitting with something that you do know about a hindrance when you're struggling will help clear it up. The second aspect of mindfulness that's so important to bring to hindrances is the notion of acceptance, of reframing what the experience is. And if you're struggling with something, it's important to notice that maybe you are having some aversion to what you're experiencing in addition to what you're experiencing. So it's, again, reframing how you're experiencing what's arising or just really trying to open and accept it. Actually, I need to say here that that's sometimes another reason why a hindrance will arise is because, you know, one of the hindrances will show up because there's something that wants to arise that you don't want to open to. If that's true, sometimes you'll get really sleepy because you don't want to see the guilt that's there, or you don't want to see some particular quality that wants to open to you, and aversion or sleepiness or doubt will arise just to prevent you from seeing it, or just for a protection for your egoic self. So that's another thing that when I'm actually struggling on the cushion and hindrances arise, my little note to myself is open, 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 open. Because there might be something there that the hindrance is trying to cover over. So recognition, just, you know, seeing if we can see what's there, having a little bit of clarity about it. Second, acceptance, just opening to it. The third quality of our mindfulness, of wise attention that we want to bring to it, is the investigation. And again, you know, one way that I'm describing mindfulness or sati nowadays is, you know, we talked about the qualities of our natural mind, and actually Rodney's been talking lately about bare attention. And bare attention or mindfulness is the active ingredient of that natural mind, of the clarity and wisdom of that natural mind. And that's what the quality of the investigation that we bring to this hindrance, or that we bring to the struggle that we're having on the cushion. It's an investigation that's not really conceptual. You know, you might use a word or hear, or, you know, a word here and there, or actually a word might pop up to you, but it's more just, you know, they actually use this, gesture to show what the investigation is. It's like your mindfulness rubbing up against the object. It's really not a conceptual, well, what could that be? And in fact, most of the time when I've tried to use my intellect to figure out what something is, I'll get the excellent instruction, don't use concepts there. Don't try to think your way to what that is. You know, just sit with that, sit with what the experience that is, get as close as to the experience that you can get with your mindfulness, and do that type of wordless investigation and see how it unfolds for you. So the investigation. So recognition, acceptance, investigation, and the N of rain is realize that it's not personal. One way I just remind myself of this is that, you know, greed existed way before I was born. And, you know, desire did, and all of these things. There's no way that somehow this is a product of just my existence on this planet. That these are forces that float around the universe, that float around, you know, conditioned experience. And depending on the causes and conditions and our certain energetic, you know, places are actually the level of our energy, they get attracted to us or repelled from us. That's another really wonderful description that Joseph shared with me that I'll share with you. He said, all we are is energetic systems, that's all we are. And so... the no-self is just to realize that we don't need to take these things personally. And another aspect of wise reflection is, and I really love this one, I want to recommend this book to you, The Meditator's Atlas, The Roadmap of the Inner World. It's actually the Visuddhimagga. You guys know the Visuddhimagga? The Visuddhimagga was a text, a really huge text that's about this big, that was written about 600 years after the Buddha, I think. And it's actually a guide map, a map of meditation. It's actually a really very involved book. And this is the Visuddhimagga in 160 pages. It's by Matthew Flickstein, and I really love it. And but anyway, one way that actually the Visuddhimagga and the text tell us wise, you know, this is another aspect of that wise attention to the hindrances is to first investigate or ask yourself a series of just really brief questions about the core nature of what you're experiencing. And I love this. They ask about the core nature of sensual pleasure. So you think about anything that you've ever really wanted, you know, maybe a piece of pie or a certain person or a piece of clothing or, you know, the latest Eileen Fisher for me, you know, what's out there? Right. And, you know, you think to yourself, how many times have I gotten that and why do I still want it, right? It's like, could any of it, you know, that last person you had the relationship with or the last kudos that you got on your job, or even the last job you got, the last award that you got. I mean, does it ever stop? It might have, you know, made us satisfied for a certain amount of time, but it is never inherently satisfying. So I think that reflection makes us realize that whatever it is we're lusting after at that moment is going to have the same fate of all of those other things, that they really are inherently unsatisfying. The second reflection is that they're impermanent. You know, regardless of whether you do get that relationship or that piece of clothing or that piece of pie, it arises and passes away. Anything that has the nature of arising has the nature to pass away. So it's inherently unsatisfactory. It's not gonna, it's not going to be there for you when you need it. And then third reflection is really, this is one of my very favorite reflections also on my cushion, is to notice how many of the thoughts that arise and the hindrances and the desires that arise are just about me trying to become something or maintain something. I mean, how many of my thoughts are me telling myself who I am? It's like, why do I do that? I know who I am. You know, it's like, yeah, you did this and you did that and they dissed you because, you know, they didn't know that you did this and you did that. And it's just amazing how many of our thoughts are just us telling us that we really do exist. And I think it's an interesting observation to see how many of those really are related to us maintaining a sense of self or identity. David Loy, a wonderful social Buddhist philosopher, says the reason why that we do that is because part of our most inherent suffering is the fact that we really don't exist, that we don't exist as a separate self. And, you know, it creates that tension in us, and that egoic sense of selfishness is always trying to create that. And, you know, trying to create that in opposition to what we really are is this sense of interconnectedness. And this person says it very well. This we know, all things are connected like the blood that unites us. We did not weave the web of life, we are merely a strand in it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. And we know the person who said that was the person that this place is named after, Chief Seattle. And that's one thing that I really find, you know, I know pride is an inappropriate, leads to suffering, but, you know, I really do believe that many indigenous communities really did understand that sense of interconnectedness. And it is absolutely true, and many of us have experienced it. And, you know, Rodney's talked about it, and it's a sense of, for me, the most profound quality of it is incredible intimacy. It's the intimacy that we're all looking for in relationship or in getting this or not getting that. And it's an intimacy that's always available to us if we would just let go of everything that's in front of it. It's not something that we have to go and get. It's just something that's already there, but it's being covered by these hindrances and by these defilements. And, you know, getting back to what the five are, they are manifested in many, many different ways. The way that they manifested for me personally, I'll tell you my hindrances and defilement stories, is one that I struggled with for a very long time and I couldn't see it, one that runs in my family actually, is self-pity. And I was sitting on retreat for my 50th birthday. I gave myself a 3-month retreat at IMS for my birthday. It was a great birthday present. But I sat there and would go through these periods of just feeling no energy and just feeling a sense of despair and of helplessness. And then all of a sudden, my mindfulness got strong enough that it just really crystallized that it was self-pity. It was really feeling sorry for myself, which is a manifestation of despair. And just to tell you how I've worked with that sense, when I was able to see it really clearly, whenever it came, it was like, you know, mindfulness, strong mindfulness is like having a picture frame, right? You throw a picture frame on something, and then you can really see it in relief. And whenever after self-pity came from that, I would throw that picture frame on it and hold it between suppression and indulgence. I wouldn't indulge it, say, wow, what are the characteristics of this self-pity? And I would, you know, just investigate it. And it really has deconditioned quite a bit. So I just want to put that out as a sense, a little story of inspiration, because it really can help you decondition some of your most negative habit patterns. One that I'm having right now, another way of working with hindrances is to guard your sense doors. And this is a one that I'm just starting to work with right now, and one that I've worked with recently by doing one thing called unsubscribing. How many, you know, for me, I don't know how many people out there who are, you know, get notices of all the sales out there. And one thing that I'm very attached to, I'm very, very greedy for a good bargain. You know, don't we want a bargain? I actually said that today and someone said, is that a hindrance? It's greed. Whenever I see 40% off clearance prices, oh my gosh. Greed just arises in my mind. Right? So I guess that's my challenge to all of us here, is to us to really investigate both on the cushion, and you know what happens on the cushion is a huge, wonderful way for investigate what these hindrances are as we walk our life. You know, Chris Prendeville said a while ago, I've heard this 1,000 times, but she said it and it totally blew my mind. She said, you know, we can get into be fetishist about meditation, but you know, this is an eightfold path that we walk. It's about, you know, our path here is 24/7. So it's a very important investigation of what are our hindrances as we're walking around in our life. Are we overly ambitious? Are we, you know, what is it that we want for ourselves? What are we greedy for? And, you know, how is that really watering the seeds of our sense of self? So, gosh, I can't believe I talked for 40 minutes. I was really nervous about this, very, very nervous. So what I think I would like us to do is, let me just say one more thing. I could probably just say that forever, but one more thing about what the classic texts say about how to handle hindrances and defilements. And there's one thing or two things actually that are advised for every single of the five hindrances, and they are sangha, good company. We were actually sitting at my house the other night, and we were so lucky that Irina Wiseman was there. And she said, you know, that is so important. Do you realize that whenever we come together and all we're talking about is how to do this transformation, how to become less selfish people, how to really be there for each other in the wisest way that we can, how to gently question each other when maybe we're making decisions that don't work. And so I wanted to read this one quotation by Ayakema. This one antidote, which is the same for all five hindrances, our five enemies, is noble friends and noble conversation. To have the kind of friends with whom one discusses not gossip, not the weather, not politics, not other people, but the way of emancipation through Dharma. Those kinds of friends are the important people in one's life. When Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and attendant, once said to the Buddha, "Sir, a good friend is half of the holy life," the Buddha said, "Do not say so, Ananda, do not say so. A good friend is the whole of the holy life. There is nothing to take the place of a spiritual friend. This is the most important person in one's life, the kind of friend who helps one remember to be on the path." So saying that, I just want to again absolutely express my gratitude to all of you for letting me take the seat and for listening patiently to me. Patience is an excellent response to the hindrances as well. And so what I'd like to do is, I think we actually have a little bit of time, so why don't we all sit for like 3 minutes, and I would like to ask all of you to just come up with pith sayings. I mean, that's one thing I love about Buddhism, is that pith teaching is really an important part of the Tibetan tradition and all of our traditions. So I'd like all of you who have an excellent pith instruction on dealing with the hindrances to please offer it to the group. And I'd also like to ask those of you who are struggling with a hindrance, if you could, to put it into a pith question and maybe pose it to the group. And Kay, let me tell you one more thing that Rodney told me the other day that totally blew my mind that I want to share. And that was, he said that we have two knowledge systems. And in his latest book, which I think is really brilliant, he talks a lot about that. He says we have a cognitive and a intuitive knowledge system, right? And actually, I've been wanting to use this quote in a Dharma talk, so I'm going to say it. Who said this? I'm sure many of you know who said this. The intuitive mind is a sacred gift, and the rational mind is a faithful servant. We live in a society that has forgotten the servant, who has forgotten the gift, and who remembers the servant. Einstein said that. That's how Einstein figured out stuff. It was through his intuitive mind, and his cognitive mind kind of filled in all the other stuff. And so, you know, Rodney said that. He said, we have two knowledge systems. We have our intuitive knowledge system, our heart system, and we have our cognitive system. And he said, you know, I was asking him about my, I said, you know, I've got a lot of different rationales for wanting to become a Buddhist teacher running around in me. What do I do about that? He said, oh, you know, don't worry about that. You're going to have conflicted motivation in your cognitive system. Go with the highest one. Just pick the highest, most selfless motivation for doing it and stick with that one, and let your other intuitive system, your intuitive, let your heart guide you to where you need to go. Just pose it as a question And I wanted to share that with you because I thought that was really excellent advice, and I've been doing that. And actually, you said that earlier. You sit with the question that you have. What's the next phase of my life? What should I do about this? Just to sit with the question and pose it to your intuitive self and see what happens. It's really a beautiful thing. So why don't we do that for a minute and then have some pith instructions and questions from all of you. Sit with it. What can we offer our Sangha tonight in pith instructions on hindrances or pith questions that we can pose to our hearts? What are we struggling with? Or questions. There are some deep practitioners in this room. You know, that's one of the nicest things about Sims is that, boy, there's people here who've been practicing for a long time. There's some very deep practice in this room. It's very sweet. Questions, comments, pith instruction, gentle criticism. Pith is just very brief and very succinct. You know, another thing that I wanted to say at the beginning was I was going to apologize because, you know, we're using concepts to describe something that's non-conceptual, right? Reality is very non-conceptual. So pith would be using like brief concepts, even poetry. I mean, I think that's why Rodney and other teachers use poetry so much, because it's what we do with all of our talks and our concepts is we point a finger at reality, but it's not reality. You know, reality is really beyond how we can conceptualize it. So I wanted to apologize for pointing a crooked finger in advance. And pith is just something very brief, and it's almost evocative of insight rather than kind of trying to conceptualize it. Any other definitions of pith? Any linguists in the room? Yeah, the heart. Oh, yes, that's right. You're an English person. The heart of something. The heart of something, yes. Tips in overcoming hindrances. How one does, who one does.
How one does what
is. You could say more about it. I didn't mean to be that pith.
Well, I'm sure I can.
No, that's excellent. I mean, I had that experience just today. I have to leave tomorrow. I just got notice like 2 minutes ago, or right before I came, that I have to go to D.C. tomorrow. And a woman sent me my ticket. She just bought the ticket today. You know, the federal government paid for it. And, you know, she had me like on just a very convoluted flight. And, you know, I'm old. I hate those convoluted flights. And, you know, I just called her right away and I said, I can't take that flight. You know, we're going to have to do something else. And I just realized right away, just I definitely threw the coffee cup down on the table, you know, and I just backed off immediately. I said, I am so sorry. I just am very concerned about this flight, and I really don't mean to take it out on you. And you're right, you know, it's just with how much care we do things, absolutely. Say more about that.
I found it really useful recently, especially in dealing with fear for me in particular, but asking where am I within this? Where is the I?
Or like who is having this experience?
Experience?
Right, yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Who is afraid?
Yeah.
Right, that's good. That's really good. Actually, the Buddha, I think, taught to say things like that, not I, not mine, not self. So, God, you intuited the Buddha's instructions. It's good. Yes.
I'm reading Ajahn Sucitto's Turning the Wheel on the Run of the Truth, and he talks about right mindfulness as a form of remembering. And he talks about how oftentimes when we're in a difficult mind state, and I notice this all the time when the hindrances come up for me, I say, oh, I'm going to be mindful now. And so I take my attention to it, and it can be too pointed and too laser-like, and it almost makes the experience more intense,
mm-hmm.
and more painful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that spaciousness that you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
And you bring in that spaciousness, then you can remember what it is that makes for moving through
That's beautiful. I love Ajahn Sucitto. I would totally recommend. I'm going to look for that. What's the name of it?
Wonderful.
What is it?
Turning the Wheel.
Turning the Wheel.
Mm-hmm.
About the Four Noble Truths?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the Four Noble Truths, just like the Five Hindrances, are part of the things for contemplation for the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So, you know, these are things that were supposed to be, according to the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, as Rodney so beautifully covered them all last year, these are, you know, bona fide objects of our mindfulness. So, one other advice that I could give, I'm actually kind of auditing James Barrez's Course in Joy. Do you guys know about that? James Barrez has a Course in Joy. It's really wonderful. And one of the advices that he gives is actually don't ignore the joy as it arises in us, to make that the object of our mindfulness, make that the object of our awareness, and just sit with it. That can sometimes decondition some of the more negative. It's a very positive and wholesome mind state, joy is. And we should definitely rest in it. We can make that the object. Look for it. Where's the joy? Carrie, do you have any advice? Sorry, Carrie. I know you have a wonderfully deep practice. I so admire your practice. That's excellent advice. In fact, yeah, that's advice, I think, in the Satipatthana Sutta. That's one of the other things in the fourth foundation, is the seven factors of enlightenment. You know, there's always something there. Even if you can't see what it is, there's something there. You know, it's maybe too subtle for you to see, or the clarity is not there, but there's something there. And it's always sweet to look for the seven factors of enlightenment, these positive qualities, and those are mindfulness, of course. And I often check into the strength of my mindfulness. How's my mindfulness? You know, you can check in with it. And actually, you can ask your mindfulness to get stronger. You can talk to yourself, mindfulness, come on, ratchet up a little bit here. You know, gently with yourself, mindfulness, can you please get stronger? And then there's investigation, that investigative quality, energy, the amount of energy that you're bringing. And then there's rapture or happiness or just a sense of real, actually a very good feeling of happiness and rapture. And then those are the enlivening factors. There's in the seven factors of enlightenment, mindfulness is in the middle, and there's three enlivening factors, and those are investigation, energy, and rapture, and there's three calming factors, and those are calm, concentration, and equanimity. And those have a particular feel to them. You can feel those things. So what does calm feel like? Oh, wow, what is that sweetness that's just enveloping me? Oh, that's calm. What does calm feel like? What does concentration feel like? What does it feel like when your energies are gathered? You know, concentration is a gathering of our energies. What does equanimity feel like? What does it feel like when it doesn't matter what's arising, that it's the quality of the attention that really makes the difference? That you have the confidence that no matter what arises, you are going to be able to hold it with some type of integrity. That's equanimity. Yes. Jerry. That's really beautiful. I've heard kind of similar to that, I heard recently, I think it was Gil Fronsdahl said, you should have the type of investigation you should have for the hindrances is as if you were from outer space and you were coming down and experiencing these human emotions for the first time. Like, what are they? I mean, what is that? I thought it was an interesting way to, you know, to think about it. Yes?
Something will happen.
You mean things will change? Something will change?
Something will happen.
Say that again. What do you
something
mean?
Will
something will happen, and maybe nothing will happen. What does that mean?
Change.
Yes, absolutely.
Wherever you are, that something is going to be different in the next moment.
That's exactly right. If it has the nature to arise, it has the nature to pass away. Absolutely. That's everything. Everything that's wonderful and everything that's bad. And, you know, I just want to say there's a stillness that's beyond all of that flowing. Even the good stuff. I mean, Ajahn Chah talked about the good stuff flowing too. It's just, it's flow as well. It feels good, but it's flow. But there's a place where there's no flow, the stillness. Oh, my gosh. It's a really interesting and, you know, it's a really wonderful place to be without the flow, the stillness.
I have a little cliche that I use on the cushion and off the cushion too, and that's if you can't get out of it, get into it.
Oh.
And it helps so much, especially with aversion.
If you can't get out of it, get into
get
it?
Get into it.
That's wisdom right there. It's very
it works
good.
Every time.
Yep.
Too.
That's great. Did you guys hear that? It's a little mantra. If you can't get out of it, get into it. If you can't get out of it, get into it. My sister lives on the Standing Rock Reservation, and her mantra, which also works for me, is life's tough, but I'm tougher. Thanks. Others? We have just a few minutes.
You get to be here too. Usually what I
get
fear or anxiety and I want to push it away or just focus on the breath. Usually when I see it and I expand over it and I say, anxiety, you get to be here too.
That's beautiful.
It works.
Yeah. That's like the acceptance. You get to be here too. Yeah, maybe that kind of reminds me for us to check how much metta do we have in our mindfulness, right? There should always be a nice dose of metta in our mindfulness, just for that. Beautifully said, thank you. Richard? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or what's trying to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, I heard another saying that was really sweet, kind of connected to that, is that, you know, there's so many things floating around our consciousness that we can choose to identify with what we want to identify with. And, you know, we can choose to identify with the equanimity that's present if we would let go of everything that's in front of it. And, you know, just have that be, you know, my experience of that was, when I first moved here, I moved here in 07 from New Mexico, and had a terrible experience with a graduate student. And it just scared me. I mean, for 6 months, I didn't even want to go into Costco because I was afraid I was going to run into her. And then one day, it just like a light turned on and said, what are you doing? You know, that is just, you know, you're stronger than that. I mean, you've put up with a divorce and this and that. And, you know, it's like so funny how much we forget, you know, the most positive qualities of us. And we could totally go there. And I think that's what I heard from you, was that, you know, it's hiding us from something, but we do have the courage. We can handle that. Go to the place where your courage is resting. That's available to you. That's your birthright as much as the rest of it. Yes. Abigail. I don't. Does somebody? I know that's a very common experience. Is there any wisdom in the room about that, Jerry? Yeah. You know, that's a really good point. I've been reading What the Buddha Taught by Rahalu, which is a really great book. And, you know, the Buddha was really straight up with people. He said, you know, the Buddha tried to get, you know, a lot of people try to get very philosophical with the Buddha, you know, tell me about this, why do we exist, how come it's like this, and he said, you know something, if I would tell you that, and if you understanding that would lead to the end of your suffering, I would tell you that, but it has nothing to do with the end of your suffering, so I'm not going to go there, which I thought was really very good. You know, it's good to remember that, some stuff leads to the end of our suffering and some doesn't. So maybe that's what Jerry meant. So it's been an evening. We've gotten through it. I've gotten through it. Yeah. Thank you.